You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hi, folks. Ben here with a quick favor to ask. There are some great advertisers who support the show, and in order for them to continue doing that, I need your help. Please do me a favor and go to podsurvey.com/kick and take a quick anonymous survey that will help us get to know you a little better. Even if you've taken our show's podcast listener survey before, the current one is new and different, so I'd really love for you to take it again. Plus, once you've completed the survey, you can enter to win a $100 Amazon gift card. Again, that's podsurvey, podsurvey.com/kick. Thanks for your help, and now enjoy the podcast. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis, and welcome to Kick-Ass News. Last year, millions of Americans watched the docuseries Making a Murderer and became completely obsessed with the strange case of a surly Wisconsin man named Stephen Avery. In 1985, Avery was arrested and convicted of sexual assault, but after serving 18 years in prison, Avery was exonerated by DNA evidence and released. He promptly filed a civil lawsuit against Manitowoc County and its former sheriff and district attorney, seeking $36 million in damages for his wrongful conviction. 2 years later, Avery was rearrested and charged with the murder of Teresa Halbach, a photographer whose SUV and charred remains were found at Avery's salvage yard. The handling of the Halbach murder case was highly controversial. Stephen Avery and his lawyers, Jerome Buting and Dean Strang, argued that he had once again been set up by his judicial adversaries. Nonetheless, he and his 16-year-old nephew, Brendan Dassey, were convicted and sentenced to life in prison. Then, 10 years later, the docuseries Making a Murderer debuted on Netflix and was seen by over 16 million Americans in its first 2 months. It raised new questions about the second Stephen Avery case, prompting over 500,000 people to sign a petition for President Barack Obama to grant Avery a pardon, and leading a federal judge to overturn Brendan Dassey's conviction, only for Dassey's release to be blocked by an appeals court. Now, Netflix has announced that there will be a second season of Making a Murderer this year, and two books with very different takes on the Avery case hit the shelves within a week of each other. Jerome Buting, the attorney who, along with his co-counsel, Dean Strang, defended Stephen Avery in the 2005 rape and murder trial, claims Avery was framed in his new book called The Illusion of Justice, Inside Making a Murderer and America's Broken System. While Ken Kratz, the prosecutor in the Avery and Dassey trials, says the evidence speaks for itself in his version titled Avery, The Case Against Stephen Avery and What Making a Murderer Gets Wrong. Today, both attorneys will argue their cases and discuss what Making a Murderer did and didn't show you. They'll both share their thoughts on the appeal of Brendan Dassey's conviction and recent statements by Stephen Avery's former girlfriend, Jody Stokowski, in which she says she now thinks Avery did it. Plus, Jerome Buting will discuss alternative suspects for the Teresa Halbach murder, and Ken Kratz reveals why Stephen Avery later struck up a pen pal correspondence with him from jail. Coming up in this special Making a Murderer episode with Ken Kratz and Jerry Buting in just a moment. Today I'm talking with Jerome Buting. He and Dean Strang were the defense attorneys for Stephen Avery in the trial that was at the center of the Netflix docuseries Making a Murderer. He writes about the Avery case and more in his new book, The Illusion of Justice, Inside Making a Murderer and America's Broken System. Jerry, thanks for joining me over Skype.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, Jerry, I'll tell you, when I first picked up the book, The Illusion of Justice struck me as a very pessimistic title. Am I to take it that after all your years as a defense attorney, perhaps you've lost faith in the system?
No, I wouldn't say that. I would say, though, that there's much that needs to be fixed with the system. If I lost faith, I would have given up a long time ago. I think, though, that there is a misunderstanding that people have that justice happens more often than it does. And, you know, one of the problems is that not every case has physical or biological evidence that can be tested for DNA and then, you know, prove someone's innocence. You know, it's estimated anywhere from 1 or 2% to as many as maybe 6 to 8% of prisoners in prison in America are probably innocent.
How did you come on to the Avery case initially?
Well, I was called by Dean Strang, who had already been hired by the family about a week or two before he called me. And I said that I was interested, but that I needed to sit down with him and see what kind of parameters there were, how we would divide the case. And then I had to talk with my law partner, who was also my wife, about a number of factors that came into play, including the strain on the business and also, as I talk about in my book, whether I was recovered enough from my serious illness to be able to take on a case of this magnitude.
And I was interested to read that apparently there was some talk among you and Dean Strang about you possibly representing Brendan Dassey. Why didn't you end up representing Brendan?
What happened was I was meeting with Dean on March 1st in his office for about an hour when the phone rang, and it was somebody from the Avery family saying that Brendan had just been arrested. They said he confessed. And at that point, we looked at each other, and I thought, you know, well, maybe I should go represent Brendan because he's going to need a lawyer now. But it didn't take long for us to realize that we'd already been talking for an hour about Stephen's case, and that therefore there was a conflict of interest for me to then go over and represent in the same case. But I've often wondered if that call had come in an hour earlier, maybe I would have been representing Brendan all along instead of Stephen.
And the confession of Stephen Avery's nephew, Brendan Dassey, and the allegations that it was coerced play a pivotal role in the narrative of Making a Murderer. But I wonder how much of the Dassey confession and questions about the tactics used by his interrogators played into your defense team strategy in the trial of Stephen Avery?
Well, it played into the strategy of our pretrial preparation because we had to deal with the reality that the entire jury pool had very likely seen or heard about Brendan Dassey's confession. And, you know, that's largely because the special prosecutor, Ken Kratz, had done this big press conference in which he graphically described Brendan's so-called confession to everybody. It was front page news, the lead story on TV news for months and months. So we knew that the jury had heard all of this. If Brendan was going to testify in our case, we were prepared for that. We actually had an expert who'd gone through his statements, who we had all of his school records, mental limitation evaluations, and all of that, so that we could show that he was a suggestible young man with a low IQ who then was subjected to these interview techniques that are risky in terms of producing false confessions with people who are young and vulnerable and with mental limitations. So we were prepared to present all of that to the jury if Brendan had been called as a state's witness. But when they decided not to use him, we weren't able to do all of that. Instead, we had to do what we could to debunk, that is, disprove those parts of the story that we knew that they would have recalled. So that's what we tried to do at the trial itself.
And after the documentary came out, there were some who felt that Stephen Avery and the Avery family talked Brendan Dassey out of a pretty good plea deal and essentially threw him under the bus to protect his uncle. I'm guessing that you don't see it that way.
No, I don't see it that way. I mean, they recorded every single conversation that Stephen Avery had with any of his family members, all of the contacts that Brendan had with his family members. You know, I think it was just Brendan's mother, who knew her son, knew his limitations better than anybody, and knew that he hadn't done this. And she did not feel it was, his attorneys were fighting for his interest and trying to represent him. And so I really think it was a matter of she believed in his innocence, and he was telling her that he was innocent. And ultimately, that's why he wasn't willing to accept any kind of a plea bargain that the state was offering.
In your defense of Stephen Avery, you submitted a number of alternative suspects that you thought had merit, but they weren't investigated. I'm sure you can't give the names of those people out, but what did you base those suspicions on? Aside from a hunch, was there any physical evidence that might have tied them to the murder of Teresa Halbach?
Well, you know, this was one of the trickiest parts of our defense, because we knew that if the jury would think that if Stephen Avery didn't do it, then who did? And so what you generally have to do is you've got to show that somebody else had the access and opportunity and a legitimate tendency to have done this crime. And problem is, there was really no motive, you know, to kill Teresa Halbach. The state never produced any either. Therefore, we were able to name the people that we thought had as much motive as Stephen, which is to say nothing, but that had access and opportunity during the time period that she disappeared to have committed the crime. Now, one of the ways that we were hindered is because of the police investigation or law enforcement investigation in this case. You know, studies have shown that somewhere in the neighborhood of 90-95% of the time when a woman is killed, the perpetrator is within her circle of men friends. That right. is a husband, ex-husband, boyfriend, ex-boyfriend, you know, somebody she works with, somebody within that circle. And therefore, that's where the initial focus of a law enforcement investigation should be. They did almost nothing in this case to investigate the people that were associated with Teresa Halbach. They instead focused only on Stephen Avery. So, you know, we named people that we thought could have been viable suspects, but frankly, there were others that I know that I can't say should have been one or more prime suspects. But because the law enforcement did no investigation, did nothing to check out where they were during the critical time periods, we were not able to even name them as possible suspects in our motion.
Do you think Detective Andy Colburn and Lieutenant James Link framed Stephen Avery?
You know, what's not all that clear in the documentary is that Stephen Avery spent the last 8 years wrongful imprisonment on that rape conviction.
Right.
In large part because Link and Colburn got a tip from another law enforcement agency that they had the wrong guy in prison, and they did nothing about it. They didn't investigate it, didn't even record it, didn't refer it to anybody to investigate. And that information came out in their depositions and depositions of a couple of other people just 3 weeks before Teresa Halbach disappeared. So they were really on the verge of becoming named defendants in that lawsuit, and they knew that. And yet, when the investigation focused on Stephen Avery and the public was being told that Manitowoc had recused themselves and had turned over the investigation to the neighboring county, Link and Colburn are the ones who raise their hands and volunteer to search Stephen Avery's trailer. Of all the things that they could have searched, 4,000 cars, many other buildings on the property, but to volunteer to search Stephen Avery, of all people and of all places, his trailer, when they knew that they had just been deposed and accused of conduct that caused him to spend another 8 years in prison, was an incredible conflict of interest and made everything that they found highly suspect.
Well, okay, then if I was to believe the idea that the police had framed Stephen Avery, explain how that would work. Who would be involved? How many moving parts would have to be at work for a conspiracy of this level to come off this perfectly?
Well, you know, it really would not have required very much. The blood was easily accessible by anybody. And, you know, what we don't know is exactly when the vehicle was discovered. There's that suspicious phone conversation where Andy Colburn is calling in the license plate 2 days before the vehicle's ever discovered. So he may, in fact, have had access, may have discovered it and had access to the vehicle as much as 48 hours before anybody knew it publicly. And, you know, we never claimed that the police were the ones who killed Teresa Halbach. What we said is that they were involved in trying to frame him. That's where we thought the evidence went. Whoever did do this, it was very obvious as of Thursday evening or Friday morning at the latest, when the news media was broadcasting that Stephen Avery had seen her, had been one of her appointments on that day, and that it was clear that the police were focusing on him. Whoever the real perpetrator was would have known. They could assume that the focus was going to be on Stephen Avery. And there probably at that point, sometime on Friday night, before the vehicle was discovered the next day, either put the vehicle on the property or dumped the bones in his burn pit or both.
Is it your belief that whoever framed Stephen Avery also killed Teresa Halbach? Or was it that they just somehow found the crime scene and then transferred it to his property and framed him? I'm confused.
Well, there was clear evidence that the bones had been moved. And the question then was who moved them and why? As the state argued, if Teresa Halbach had been killed and mutilated and burned her body in the burn pit outside of Stephen Avery's trailer, then why were just a few of the bones moved, and why were they found in a burn barrel, you know, couple hundred feet away behind the Dassey house? You know, first of all, if she was burned somewhere else, then clearly Stephen Avery was not guilty, because nobody would kill a person, burn them, and right, then dump the remains on your own backyard. But only about 40% of her skeleton was ever recovered. Some of those bones were mixed in to within this burn barrel. And we think that what made most sense is that somebody used that burn barrel to scoop up her remains from the original site, dumped them on Stephen Avery's burn pit, and then put the burn barrel behind the Dassey house, and some of the bones remained stuck in the bottom of that burn barrel.
I see.
One of the things that was difficult about this is that for some completely unexplainable reason, the state had absolutely no pictures of the bones as they were found in the burn pit, in the burn barrel. In the burn pit, they just took a shovel and you know, disrupted it all and dumped it into a sifter and then into a box and destroyed whatever possible evidence there might have been or clues there might have been about whether the burn pit, Stephen Avery's burn pit, was the original site of burning.
Well, then, Jerry, how should they have gone about this?
What should have been done, and normally would have been done, is the coroner would have taken over. A coroner has legal jurisdiction, a county coroner, for any remains found out in the elements. And the coroner in this case was barred from the property, refused to go. She had already arranged for forensic anthropologist, archaeologist type individual to come who could do a grid where you lay out like you'd see in archaeology excavation, that would have told us if, for instance, the forearm was next to the the upper arm, you know, bones that were contiguous to each other in a manner that would have indicated that that was where her body originally was burned. None of that was done. No pictures were taken. So all that evidence was lost. To this day, totally unexplainable and unjustifiable failure of the state to preserve the evidence as it was found, even by simple photographs.
And I want to talk about the prosecutor, Ken Krantz. Prior to the trial, you know, like most criminal defense attorneys and prosecutors, there's at least a civil relationship. You say that it soured as the Avery trial drug on. Why weren't you two able to maintain some kind of professional courtesy toward the end?
I found his behavior in doing that press conference unforgivable. He destroyed my client's, even Avery's, opportunity to get a fair trial by poisoning the jury pool in the entire state of Wisconsin. Prosecutors are not supposed to do that. You know, they're not supposed to make public statements that can influence the ability of a defendant to get a fair trial. From that point on, I just didn't get along with him particularly well.
Well, one of the people who helps portray Stephen Avery in a more favorable and sympathetic light in the documentary is his girlfriend, Jody. She has since recanted her support for him. She says he used to beat her. She now says that she believes that he was guilty, and if he hadn't gone to prison, she probably wouldn't be alive today. You tell me, should we give her statements any weight, or is this just sour grapes from a spurned ex, a woman trying to milk her 15 minutes of fame? What is this?
You know, I can't ascribe a particular motivation to her. All I know is that she's a woman who has obviously had a lot of issues. She was in jail on her multiple drunk driving offenses at the time of the arrest of Stephen Avery. She had claimed that about a year earlier, there was an incident where the police came out to the trailer, and she had made claims that she had been beaten and strangled and unconsciousness and this and that. And the police report of that particular investigation made note of the fact that she had not a single mark on her, no evidence that she'd been beaten whatsoever, that she was extremely intoxicated. And it was pretty clear they didn't believe her story at that time. Mm. Now, the claims later that he somehow was threatening her, that's just preposterous. You know, every word that Stephen Avery spoke to Jody from the moment that he was arrested, and even before that, because she was in jail, was recorded and listened to. And so if there was evidence that he was threatening her, we would have heard about it long before now.
Now, there is a second season coming this year. Have you been contacted by the filmmakers?
I've been contacted by them, but I don't know whether we will be in it. That's going to be up to them. My hunch is that it will probably be focused on going forward, whether the new developments in the case, in which case Dean and I will, you know, aren't directly involved in that. So we'll just have to wait and see.
Is there one thing that we don't see in the documentary that you would like for people to know or take from this?
All you see in the documentary is focused on the Stephen Avery case and the Brendan Dassey case. And so in my book, I tried to broaden that and let people know that a lot of these things are more common than you might think. The same time that Avery was going on, yeah, it was a pretty wild case with a lot of twists and turns, but so was the Ralph Armstrong case. Prosecutor knew a third party had confessed 13 years earlier, and he never told anybody. And that, combined with the destruction of evidence, caused the judge to dismiss the case on outrageous government misconduct. And, you know, that's the one lesson I think people need to take away from this is that they need to be vigilant and watch what's going on in their own individual courthouses, because it happens not, unfortunately, infrequently enough.
Yeah. Well, again, the book is called The Illusion of Justice, Inside Making a Murderer and America's Broken System. Jerry Buting, thanks so much for joining me over Skype.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
We're going to take a quick break, and then when we come back, you'll hear the other side of the Making a Murderer case with special prosecutor Ken Krantz. When we come back in just a moment. Folks, whether you're starting an online business or trying to get your existing business online, GoDaddy wants to help. GoDaddy's mission is to radically shift the global economy toward life-fulfilling independent ventures, helping customers kick ass by giving them the tools, insights, and the people to transform their ideas and personal initiatives into success. With more than 62 million domain names under management, GoDaddy is the world's largest technology provider dedicated to small business and the largest domain registrar. They have award-winning 24/7 support and everything you need to build your online business. Whether you have a new idea or an established business, the key to success online starts with a great domain name, and GoDaddy is trusted by 13 million customers, more than any other registrar, with big savings over the other guys. And right now, my listeners can get 30% off new purchases on GoDaddy.com by using the code KICK30 at checkout. That's GoDaddy.com, code KICK30 for 30% off. Again, GoDaddy.com and offer code KICK30. And now, back to the podcast. Ken Kratz was the special prosecutor in the Stephen Avery and Brendan Dassey trials. He was portrayed as an overzealous prosecutor and perhaps even as part of a conspiracy to frame Stephen Avery in the Netflix series Making a Murderer. Now he says he's setting the record straight by sharing the evidence you didn't see in the TV series in his new book called Avery, The Case Against Stephen Avery and What Making a Murderer Gets Wrong. Ken Kratz, thanks for joining me.
Oh, thanks very much. Nice to be here.
This case is so old. It's from, what, 2006? Is it strange to be suddenly having to revisit what you assumed was a closed case from 10 years ago?
10 years after the fact, to be discussing one of my prosecutions still, and for the kind of attention that this has derived is really surprising. Remember, though, that the victim's family, Teresa's family, the Halbachs, have to answer questions and to listen to alternate theories and listen to, things about forensic evidence and the like. So it does all of us some good to remember that there are real people at the other end of this story, and that we should keep those people in our thoughts and prayers.
Yeah, and going back to the events of that day, October 31st, Stephen Avery was already sort of a celebrity in Wisconsin. He had been wrongfully convicted. His case had been overturned. So I'm sure that you were aware of him. What did you think when you first heard that Teresa Halbach's car was found on the Avery compound?
I was aware of Stephen Avery at the time, but I certainly didn't know the details of his case. I was a prosecutor in a county which was adjacent to Manitowoc County. My home county, Calumet County, is where Teresa Halbach resided. And so on the 4th of November, as an example, I was already involved in the case from a missing persons standpoint. We were trying to find Teresa. We were trying to do some cell tracking information with our phone and some financial records information to try to find her. But when her SUV that she was driving was located the morning of the 5th of November, I remember getting the call shortly before noon on that Saturday. I had a lunch date that I was just about to go on with my wife at the time, and the call comes in. Of course, I had to instead go to the Avery salvage property and assist with the search warrants and other parts of the investigation that a DA is asked to assist, which really changed the course of this investigation.
Do you subscribe to the theory that Avery's wrongful or at least partially wrongful conviction and his 18 years in prison made Stephen Avery into a murderer?
I have the theory that every day that Stephen Avery sat in his jail cell, he was thinking of what he was going to do when he got out. I do base that upon statements that he made to other inmates where he had indicated his intent to build a torture chamber when he was released, his intent to abduct and rape and kill young women. And so since Mr. Avery was talking about that the entire time that he was in a confined setting, the fact that that's exactly what he did upon his release shouldn't have surprised, you know, that many people. Mr. Avery, in my opinion, was planning this crime right down to where it was to occur, how he was going to dispose of the body, both of which were specifics that he talked about while he was in custody.
And one thing that I didn't really get from the TV series is there seems to be some evidence that this wasn't just a sudden crime of passion or Avery just losing it, but it was premeditated. Talk about some of the weird things leading up to this crime that suggest that maybe he had targeted Teresa.
Stephen Avery had lured this photographer onto the property on the 31st of October. We know that he had set up an appointment for a photo shoot of a car that he had been selling, but when he had called the Auto Trader magazine, who Teresa had been taking photographs for, he had used a different name. He had used a different phone number. These were a name and phone number of his sister. He also called Teresa's phone twice the afternoon of the 31st using what's called the Star 67 feature on his phone, which blocked the identity of his phone call. He did not want her to know who she would be meeting with when she came to the Avery property on the 31st. Some of this has to do with a previous encounter the two of them had on the 10th of October at the same property where Stephen Avery had answered the door only wearing a towel, and Ms. Halbach had expressed some natural surprise at that state of affairs. And so my sense is that Stephen believed that Teresa may not want to just voluntarily come back to his property. And so using a different name, a different phone number, and blocking the identity of his calls were ways that that he secured her appearance. When she arrived, however, though, I have to assume, of course, that she had no idea what was in store for her when she did arrive, though, on the property on the 31st.
Yeah, and in the series Making a Murderer, Stephen Avery is portrayed as kind of this guy who's been picked upon and just wants to be left alone. You point out in the book that he was no choir boy even before the wrongful conviction, right?
Oh, that's very true. You know, he had engaged in some very disturbing behavior with, he had burned a cat alive.
Wow.
Which had shown a real sadistic side to him. He also had engaged in some violent behaviors towards women. In fact, several of the women that Stephen Avery were in relationships with after removing themselves from the relationship would confide that they felt lucky to have escaped those relationships alive. That's how terrified they were about the conduct and behavior that Mr. Avery had engaged in. If you watched Making a Murderer, though, you never would have known these things.
Yeah, and in Making a Murderer, they kind of portray his relationship with Jodi Stokowski, his fiance, as some kind of a Romeo and Juliet story. Now she has turned on him and said that she was afraid of him, and she believes that he did it, right?
Well, she says a lot more than that, but suffice it to say that Ms. Stokowski now believes that should she have remained in a relationship with Stephen Avery, that she also would have had her life taken.
And wow.
So there's always the possibility with broken up relationships that, you know, there's bad blood there, or there is embellishment. In fairness, the jury never got to hear of Stephen Avery's prior abuse towards Jody Stokowski or his burning of a cat or the fact that he had raped two other women before the judge believed were too prejudicial for the jury to hear and to be considered.
A lot has been made of Brendan Dassey's testimony, but you say Avery was convicted on the blood, the key, the bones, and the bullet, not Dassey's testimony.
I never introduced Brendan Dassey's statement at all into Stephen Avery's trial. And so his conviction is based solely on the forensic evidence that was developed and analyzed. Stephen Avery's blood is found inside of the victim's SUV in six different places. And so he had a cut on his right middle finger on the 31st that day. We know that because of some photographs and other evidence that we received about this cut. But it's how the blood is left, Ben, that is so compelling in our opinion. It isn't just gravity that drips the blood in these places. Some of these stains are contact transfer stains where Stephen Avery's finger comes in contact with the ignition or with the CD case in her car or with the seat. Or there's other kinds of blood pattern evidence that tells a story for the jury. The defense, of course, had suggested that the defendant was the victim of a conspiracy by law enforcement, that law enforcement had obtained evidence against him, had planted that evidence against him, had wished right. to frame him for a crime that that he didn't commit. Then at trial, we had the ability to refute all of those claims of planting and that kind of nonsense. The problem was during the docuseries, the way in which the evidence that happened at a trial was presented to the audience was in such a way that you wouldn't have believed that the state had any evidence against him at all. It depicts him as being very much the victim of kind of the Keystone Cops bungling a group of individuals that are out to do anything to frame him for a murder. And that, of course, when you read my book and when you go through the facts in a more thorough, painstaking way, you'll see it was virtually impossible for any of that to have happened, and that we should be and are around these parts of Wisconsin very proud of the efforts of law enforcement and the prosecution in holding this man responsible for Teresa's murder.
Yeah, and making a murderer, and the defense made a big deal out of the fact that there was a little hole in the lid on the blood samples, suggesting that maybe they had been tampered with or that someone had taken some blood from there and then planted it in the car. You have a pretty simple explanation for why there was a hole in the lids of the blood samples, right?
Yeah, every tube of blood that is drawn at a hospital or a clinic by any phlebotomist or nurse or anybody else who draws it, these purple top tubes, they all have holes in them. I always say, how do you think the blood gets in the tube? It has to get in there somehow. And so they get it in through a needle that goes right into the rubber stopper on top. And when you pull the needle out after putting blood into the tube, that leaves a little hole in the top. But what the filmmakers did is they presented this vial of blood as a smoking gun of tampering, and that it was obvious that this was the blood that had been used to plant the evidence against Mr. Avery. Of course, we provided scientific evidence which refuted that. There's a preservative that is in the purple-topped tube blood that was in the Cougar Courts office that was not present in the SUV or in the blood samples that Stephen left from his active bleeding, which means, of course, that the tube of blood in the clerk's office could not scientifically be the source of the blood that was recovered from Stephen Avery's blood that he deposited by his active bleeding in Teresa's vehicle. And so once common sense takes over again, and once you're able to look at actual evidence, suggestions like that, although they might be interesting to talk about sitting around a fireplace, they don't have much more evidentiary value than that when it comes right down to deciding if somebody's guilty or not guilty.
Is the bullet the proverbial smoking gun against Stephen Avery?
I think so, Ben. I think when you realize the bullet is found in a garage, it's almost a pristine bullet, at least pristine to the point of having all of the markings upon it, the striations, the fact that that bullet passes through your body and, of course, has the DNA on it. And thereafter, when you consider that the bullet is forensically matched to a rifle that is hanging above Stephen Avery's bed in his bedroom, that is pretty compelling, pretty damning evidence. Now, the filmmakers, when it doesn't fit their narrative of innocence, they don't have an explanation for things like the bullet and it matching that gun. They simply don't tell the audience about it. And so the fact that the bullet is matched to Stephen Avery's rifle compared to any other rifle in the world is never mentioned in the documentary. It's intentionally withheld from consideration, as are many, many facts which demonstrate quite unequivocally that Stephen Avery is guilty of homicide.
Brendan Dassey's case is being appealed on the grounds that his defense says he was coerced or misinformed, didn't understand the situation he was in. Watching the film, I can kind of see how one gets that impression. You know, he doesn't seem to quite understand how much trouble he's in. You say that's nonsense. What didn't we see?
You were shown exactly what they wanted you to see. Mm-hmm. You saw one snippet of one interview. That interview itself lasted almost 4 hours. Brendan Dassey gave six different statements to law enforcement. He also made dozens of recorded jail phone calls with his mother and with other family members and other individuals where he makes admissions of his involvement in the homicide and the rape of Teresa Halbach. Yet you aren't shown any of that. You're shown a young man who is obviously out of his element with the interrogation. He's obviously overwhelmed by the circumstance in the sense that he hadn't gone through that before. Yet he's able to answer truthfully when he chooses to. He knows right from wrong. Provides very detailed narrative when he chooses to. Much of this material is available both on the internet and elsewhere that can be reviewed. And you can see just how these filmmakers went about fooling millions and millions of people about both Stephen Avery and Brendan Dassey and their involvement in this horrible crime.
In the book, some people might be surprised that you say that he is a victim as well.
Yes.
You say that he was made a sacrificial lamb. By whom?
One of the real tragic turns in this case, again, in my opinion, comes when I offer Brendan Dassey a plea offer. I offer him 15 years imprisonment recommendation in which he'd be out, I think it'd be like 5 years from now. And it isn't Brendan's lawyers who turned down the plea offer, which is a very fair plea offer. It's Brendan's own family that tells Brendan not to accept the plea bargain, not because of how it might affect Brendan's case, but how it's going to impact Stephen Avery's case. If you think about that, Ben, you've got a young man, a developmentally disabled 16-year-old, really needing the advice from those loved ones around him. And rather than obtaining the kind of advice that's going to be in his best interest, He's, as it turns out, given advice that helps his uncle's case, but does very little to further Brendan's case at all. And I think that accurately then characterizes Brendan as another victim of this case.
Yeah, and you say that you do have one regret, the press conference around the charging of Brendan Dassey. What was part of your decision to do that, and why do you regret it now?
I regretted afterwards that my voice or my face was attached to actually repeating those facts or telling people what was in the complaint. That probably should have come either from defense attorneys or from the media, and not from the prosecutor. I took great pains my entire career and not being on TV very much and not being on the media very much. And I always say now, how'd that work out for me? So it just seems it doesn't work out very well at all. But I would have certainly just released the information to the public and not have made any public statements about it at all.
Yeah, and you chose not to participate in the filming of Making a Murderer, not to give an interview. Looking back, do you wish that perhaps you had, and that way maybe you could have helped control the narrative?
Well, I wasn't going to control this narrative. There were two filmmakers who had an agenda. What most people don't realize is that Making a Murderer was the second movie to be made by these filmmakers of the Stephen Avery case. The first was a 2008 movie that was presented at the Columbia Film Festival, and it was a smaller, a shorter version, but showed, at least in my opinion, what would be their true agenda, you know, what they really wanted to portray in this case. I had asked them to see their finished product that thousands of people had already seen at the film festival, and they declined. They said, "We don't want to show that to you." I've made several attempts since. I've contacted Columbia. I've contacted Netflix. I've contacted the filmmakers. That film's buried. No one's going to see it. And so it would sure be interesting to see what the first version was that these two created.
You dedicate a whole chapter to the so-called villains of Making a Murderer. Your colleagues, Detective Andy Colburn and Lieutenant James Lenk, they were portrayed as being behind some kind of a conspiracy to frame Stephen Avery. What do you want to say about their character and how this has affected them?
You know, Andy Colburn and Jim Lenk were remarkably honest and good detectives who, for their entire careers, had done nothing to bring upon themselves any kind of shame or any kind of doubt as to their competence or as to their honesty. And what this film has done is it's stolen from them their reputations. They're now considered crooked cops. They're now considered to be, you know, the bad guys, when there's been nothing, no evidence, not one shred that points to anything other than an exemplary job by these two guys. And so I tell people what these two guys have had to endure since this happened: the death threats, the threats at their home, and receiving exploding packages in the mail, and things like that. I hope people understand that this isn't a blood sport. You shouldn't be able to use either the internet or even beyond that to take out your frustrations on two really really good cops. So when it's all said and done, of course, I'm hoping that these officers will be able to get back their reputations and enjoy the compliments for their service that they deserve, rather than being targeted as villains without any proof in a really shameful way that I think these filmmakers have done for them.
I think you said you got something like 4,000 threats, right?
Yeah, I did. And you know, when you receive, you know, just kind of general, you know, "We don't like you, Ken," or you know, something mocking, that's okay. You just kind of learn to live with that. But when you receive emails with the degree of specificity of, you know, "We hope your daughter gets raped and you have to sit and watch it."
Wow.
And much worse than that, what I can't repeat on the radio, it makes you wonder, don't they realize that to extend your hatred and your angst to me personally, or to my daughter for that matter, is something that is troubling indeed. It talks way more to what the society, I think, is becoming, Ben, than anything that might be, you know, relevant to me or even this case.
Yeah. Well, before we go, I was amazed to read that Stephen Avery actually struck up a written correspondence with you 6 years after the trial. What did he want and what was in those letters?
Well, Stephen Avery and I exchanged letters, and one of those letters, Stephen Avery asked me if I would handle his appeal for him. Stephen suggested, since I was no longer working for the state and he didn't have a lawyer, that he thought I could be his lawyer and we could both make money off of the deal. And I quickly told him that was a really bad idea and that I wasn't going to be doing that. But I had given Mr. Avery an opportunity, should he have wanted to tell what happened. You know, all of his appeals were done at that time, Ben, and I thought it was a really interesting opportunity to get into the mind of this guy and have him perhaps tell his side. He wasn't going for it though, and that's fine. And so we discontinued our pen pal relationship after that.
And didn't he want to meet you? Said he wanted to ask you something or tell you something.
Oh yeah, he put me on his visiting list in prison, and we made an appointment for me to come to the prison to visit him. It was the warden that had rejected his request to let me come visit him. Apparently the warden didn't think a Kratz Avery reunion was in anybody's interest, and so he thought better of that. And so we didn't ever get that opportunity, which is fine. He's got his lawyers and plenty of people that want to talk to him. And as it turns out, I've got better things to do now, too.
Well, it just gets stranger and stranger. The book is called Avery, The Case Against Stephen Avery and What Making a Murderer Gets Wrong. Ken Kratz, thanks for joining me.
Thanks very much, Ben. I appreciate it.
Folks, this case has raised some pretty intense emotions, and I suppose everyone has to make up their own mind about whether Stephen Avery murdered Teresa Halbach on that chilly Halloween in 2005. A jury of his peers convicted him after seeing and hearing 7 weeks' worth of evidence. I figured that probably trumps my watching a 10-hour miniseries. As the old saying goes, where there's smoke, there's usually fire. Or unfortunately, in this case, charred human remains. All I know is elaborate conspiracy theories are very hard to cover up, the simplest explanation is usually the best, and a wrongful conviction is not a lifetime get-out-of-jail-free card. Thanks again to Jerome Buting and Ken Kratz for joining me on the podcast. If you enjoyed this episode and want to get either or both sides of the case, then you can order their books on Amazon or download the audio versions for free with a special offer just for our listeners at audibletrial.com/kickassnews. Jerome Buting's book is called The Illusion of Justice, Inside Making a Murderer and America's Broken System. And Ken Kratz's book is Avery, The Case Against Stephen Avery and What Making a Murderer Gets Wrong. And of course, you can always watch all 10 episodes of Making a Murderer with a subscription to Netflix. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. Don't forget to take our listener survey. It only takes 5 minutes at podsurvey.com/kick. You can visit Kick-Ass News on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And be sure to recommend Kick-Ass News to your friends on your social media. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at gofundme.com/kickassnews or click on the donate button at kickassnews.com. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.